The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 321. What God was saying at the cross, God's message to humanity through his son's death, a sermon by the Reverend Steve Sandlin, and Christ and Paradox, a sermon by Arthur C. Wiscombe.
The Reverend Steve Sandlin is scheduled to go first. He's not here, so we'll begin with Arthur Wiscombe, and then I'll introduce the Reverend afterwards when he comes, and I'll probably actually leave and place a quick call to make sure he's got the time right and everything. Arthur C. Wiscombe is a retired philosopher, writer, educator, and his text will be Matthew 10:39.
I hope our guest arrives so that we can complete our program, but I will proceed. As I have grown older, gradually I came to realize that of all the marvelous teachings of Christ, paradox is of all one of the most intriguing. And perhaps in more situations than we know, it might be because it becomes the canopy and the essence of wisdom itself. That is, wisdom hidden within the paradox. Canopy implying coverage, hiddenness, making it perhaps more difficult to discern, to ferret out. So the paradox, a statement, doctrine, or expression seemingly absurd or contrary to the received belief, or to what would naturally be believed, but perhaps really true. And of course, in that really possibly trueness is the agony. So could we say it's perceived reality turned upside down? A statement seemingly contrary to common sense, yet possibly true in fact, and full of significance. At least in part because of its contradictory qualities. The paradox as a rhetorical device is full of surprises and often produces a memorable message and passage. So we're looking at the contradiction, the ambiguity, the absurdity, the mystery, the enigma, the inconsistency, the puzzle, the perplexity, the polarity, the contraries, the opposites, these antagonisms or inversions, the antithesis. And can we ferret all this out in our own lives, in our religious lives, for ourselves? So Christ and paradox, he had a bundle of them, and it's my intent to show and to help us just think together in moving out far afield from the package which he rendered as a teaching device. He that findeth his life must first lose it. The first is to be last, the poorest, the richest, the weakest, the strongest, the most obscure, the most celebrated. That he came not with peace, but with a sword. Yet those who would gain a life then must first lose it, you say. If I am to possess, I must first dispossess, and thus find self-possession. If I am to be the greatest, I must genuinely present myself as the least, the servant of all. You may ask, do you mean to tell me that Christ seriously taught that to go forward, we must stop on occasion and go backward? I guess that's what paradox means. So we go forward by going backward. He said, unless ye become as the little child you once were, ye cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. So the wise think, ponder, turn back, and seek to reclaim those virtues lost in our growing up. Now let's look at a child just in passing. Children are not fixated and spoiled by a personal policy of rancor, prejudice, and hate. Children don't daily go to and fro in the earth practicing predatory capitalism. So we go forward even on occasion as we go backward. The prodigal son, yes. But the zinger in the paradox is that there is a second pious lad, as aberrated and unwhole as the wayward. The Jericho Road, and the question is asked, who is my neighbor? And we have an untouchable, a Samaritan, a wretched reject of hallowed society. This isn't a good question to raise, but would the chauffeur of the Lincoln Town Car stretch limo carrying our own prophet who lives in a penthouse be inclined to stop on that road? But more important than that, would I? But you say, all this paradox seems so absurd, and so it is. Are you going to tell me something ridiculous like Christ and Christianity are incompatible? No, I'm not going to say that, because Dostoevsky and the Grand Inquisitor did it far better than could I. But Brother Wiscombe, I want to quest after happiness. Is Christ's paradox going to tell me that I should abandon my quest, that I might achieve my goal? Yes, because we assure the loss by the same degree that we mount the direct onslaught. Happiness does not lend itself to being seized by the throat. Happiness to the wise is always a byproduct, the fruit of other quests, other attainments, and it is never permanent, as fleeting as a butterfly. So is our happiness in our trek through the celestial valley of hell. Are you going to tell us that often our most cherished, holy, and revered doctrine is fraudulent? How absurd, strange, yes, but true on occasion. Christ knew better than anyone that it was doctrine, eternal, absolute doctrine that got him crucified. Did our isolated hermit on Walden Pond ever state a grand paradox? Yes. He said that sometimes in considering the bureaucratic institutional things, sometimes our greatest revelation is to learn there was no revelation at all. I shouldn't say this, but isn't it just a little insulting to the gods in our culture? Even in 1978, for saints to demand a revelation telling us that love is superior to hate. And Joseph Smith, did he deal with this paradox? Yes, he once penned, some revelations are of God, some revelations are of men, and some revelations are of the devil. Well, could he have added, and some revelations simply never happened. If we are to be among the perceiving, we must attune our senses to the lessons of the paradox, and strange as that may seem, give them an open hearing, at least. Is there a paradox in Christian history? The woman at the tomb. She was disbelieved by the priesthood chain of command because she was a woman. Two men on the road to Emmaus. A third man fell in step behind, who recognized that, metaphysically speaking, authority also comes from the bottom up. Could it? Well, I was taught if this thing called a spirit body, enters a physical body and makes it a living mortal, and something called intelligence enters into that heavenly spiritual body that it is mind to make it a living spiritual body, and if that intelligence is some essence of the I in me, and if that's an uncreated and thus indestructible essence of the cosmos itself, as old as that in the deities themselves, an absolute given fixation in the reality of the cosmos itself, then Roberts and John Stuart Mill, you know, may have been right that this thing can stand and say no against all the myriads of the entities of the galaxies demanding a yes. So yes, formal authority always comes from the top down, and that is the nature of bureaucracy, isn't it? But wouldn't it be a strange paradox if there is an ultimate metaphysical authority moving from the bottom up in the cosmos? And what would be the implication of that for leadership being invited from the bottom up as well as revered from the top down? It might change a lot of things to an increased level of the noble. The Samaritan woman and Jacob's well. I want to stop just a moment on those previous two. These two fellows walking on the road and a singular woman being first. I can't think of any two examples in Holy Writ more appropriate to the moral imperative of our time than those two. Think of them. The one is dealing with the repressed half the human race, and the other is a recognition, as Jefferson and de Tocqueville so eloquently stated, that there's something extraordinarily common in the common person that needs to be tapped and unleashed. His own expected a glorious appearance of a god, a king, a prince, all of which he was, but he appeared as an infant, as a pauper in a stable manger with a room in the inn, this world maker, molder of galaxies, and unknown. Is there paradox in American history? Yes, everywhere the discerning eye turns, our history is filled with paradox. The occasion was the battlefield at Gettysburg, and the president was not the main speaker who had spoken for 2 hours, but this was a 2.5 minute talk. And I want to share with you a line that is so moving to me when he said, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here." And as he spoke that paradox, those very words were soaring to the mountain peak of American and world literature. By the grace of God, he thought he had said nothing, and it was everything in a serene humility that is without peer in world literature. And though he was the president and had the power and the fame, there was internalized in his reference the appreciation for the myriads of unknown who paid the last full measure of devotion. The Warren decision, Brown versus Board of Education, 1954. Our racial hatred problems. And 22 million blacks stood with held breath for a unanimous high court to get the moral imperative exacted. And as Warren pulled that unanimous vote off, the whole court had to race into oblivion the other way to the shock of our black citizens. It's all we could do to get a decision. Now, for decades to come, we must play like there was no revelation at all. This tells us a lot about who we are, doesn't it? And what we ought to strive to be. If we're going to be a noble creature, if I'm going to make myself the embraceable man by the grace of God, I have to get digging into my illusions and find the courage to uproot a few before I die, that I might reclaim a dignity that should be my own to hold and to share with my brothers and my sisters. The civil rights movement received its most powerful direction from the forces of agnosticism, of skepticism, of humanism, and of secularism. The Christian and religious forces were the last to give up races in our society and fought the moral liberating forces from the gods every step of the way. If you want a paradox, grab that one. So the question is, what is there in the religious impulse that allows us to so dehumanize ourselves and our brother? So overwhelmingly so. And our sisters. Dwight D. Eisenhower led the command and commanded the Allied expeditionary forces, D-Day at Normandy. But as President of the United States of America, he cowered away in cold sweat when Senator Joseph McCarthy held a nation hostage to fear. And even when the brash, impudent young senator in Wisconsin attacked General George C. Marshall, the president still slinked away to isolated oblivion. Bertrand Russell, short one, came over here, looked around, see if he could find anybody great in America. Went back to London, sat, penned that little thing. There's a guy over there on Harvard Square named William James, who is utterly oblivious to his own greatness. I love that. 15 students hanging on his coattail, running across the square between class to class, trying to catch the golden impulse off his lip. And so busy being one of the grandest teachers America ever produced to get lost in his own importance. The late James Scotty Reston, that Mary you must have known very well living your lifetime in Washington, said it is a paradox that our failed immigration policy with Mexico has been one of our modern glories, perhaps averting a class and economic war with our neighbors itself. Is there a paradox in Mormon history? My friend Wayne Carlyle, had left the city superintendency here of schools, was one in the Chicago area, and he took the superintendency in Dayton, Ohio. Like the rest of us, like his friend Carl Sandburg here and others, myself, our great political science brother here from Utah State, you see, he had everything. Married in the temple, returned missionary, and all of the credentials, you see. But when a city, a large city in America, nearly 50% black in its city school population, found in the 60s that they had a Mormon school superintendent, intelligent black people wanted to raise the question as to whether his views were the same as his tradition. Are our children in your school system, sir, second class, or less than yourself? And he reassured them vigorously and honestly where he stood. And for being honest, in June, the stake presidency and the bishopric and the high council that June excommunicated him. He had five children, split the family wide open. Later, I was sitting at the back of the bus in downtown New Orleans at a national school superintendent's conference, and I saw my Mormon friend step onto the front of the bus. And by the grace of God, I wanted to walk up the aisle and embrace him. Because in his trial in the Mormon ward that night, he was the only one with his dignity intact. Can you appreciate how embraceable that makes one in that condition? To be able to do that and rise out of the ant heap and for a moment in time be a man. Isn't that worthy of embrace? And suffer so badly for it. As some of the greatest philosophical minds of the 20th century, in persons of Alfred North Whitehead, John Dewey, and Charles Hartshorne, and others have gravitated to process theology. We've had many of our own leaders want to declare the sermon itself a misprint and its message erroneously interpreted to the world. So, as Hugh Brown achieved a near consensus of church leaders to abolish religious sanctioned racism before 1978, Harold B. Lee held out and went to his grave knowing it was God's will that the priesthood would never be given to the blacks in this life. And for all the years J. Reuben Clark dominated the first presidency with God's will, his own position, not to have a church college in Hawaii over the years of vocal opposition by David O. McKay. That argument went on for decades. But the first week when David O. McKay replaced the other prophet that J. Reuben Clark always spoke for, we get into groundbreaking for a church college in La'ia. And look what it has done to serve thousands and thousands of struggling brown-skinned people reaching out for an enlarged sense of worth. And then you can turn that completely upside down, because Clark and McKay were two lovable, wonderful men. In October of 1945, President Clark is ready to read a change in Mormon policy on race. But unfortunately, for private reasons unrelated to the issue, McKay forbid him to proceed, thus delaying this matter of justice for millions of citizens of the human race for another quarter of a century. Paradox? Oh. A religious world pressing for ecumenical love and cooperation and mutual acceptance, and we will not allow a professor in our own university to walk into a public arena and share an idea in the open marketplace. Isn't there paradox in that bit of absurdity? Where's our leader here? Did our other speaker come? He is not yet. So I'm okay. Well, I'm okay. If you're okay with me, I'm okay with it. Okay? I just want to properly honor him. And do you think the BYU president can stand forthright and share a political idea, Claude, in the world marketplace on ecumenical thrusts? And if not, why not? I believe you've got your revelation and I have mine. And since I'm the speaker, we're dealing with mine right now. But I believe the greatest revelation to have occurred in Mormonism during the last quarter of the 20th century is the emergence of a vast number of brilliant, educated, cultured, and cultivated women arising to the vision of the possible. And I feel it a personal honor to be able to walk among many of these noble and great ones in the corridors of Sunstone. Unlike old salty brother Sea Captain Watts last night, I'm one of the few people around here who has attended all these Sunstones for a quarter of a century from the very beginning. Paradox? Do you know what this revelation is going to unleash on God's earth? When we take a repressed half the human race and give them a vision of the possible, and they respond to that in culture, in an intelligent, with informed minds, with loving hearts, thrusting into the environment of the valley of hell. Paradox, by the grace of God, even high-ranking apostles believe the whole movement to be the work of the devil. How am I to deal with that? Well, lovingly, of course, and understandingly, of course, and patiently of necessity. Is the paradox of Christ visible in our personal histories? Well, if we keep journals that, like I have since the age of 16, we find them. I just published two big, thick volumes of my missionary journals when I was 19. I kissed an expectant bride, good home in the Salt Lake, goodbye in the Salt Lake Union Pacific Depot. I'd only been married less than a month, and I went on a mission. And when our first and only son, firstborn, was announced on February 26th of 1949, I was elated and wrote in my journal, "Dear Mary, that I'm very happy that I decided to forego a honeymoon for a mission for my God. And I've been rewarded a son. Otherwise, we might have had a girl." That's what I wrote at 19. Assuredly so, feelingly so, and God gave me a rose. He gifted me over the fertile years to follow 5 beautiful daughters in a row to correct a young elder's metaphysical aberration. And when I walk into the crowded rooms and make eye contact with these my own, I know that this is an everlasting gift for all time and for all eternity in the nature of their being. Don't tell me our daughters are not equally worthy in absolute value to any privilege out of government or out of the ecclesiastical domains would be accorded to our son. And I love him so much too. My own extended family, out of their love for me, the philosopher in the family, sent my name on a number of occasions to the temple altar to be prayed for because of my views on race out of harmony with the brethren. Now, why in my old dementia do I find the word brethren so awful? I mean, it's just a simple, innocent word. It used to be just a grand, plain word. And it's taking on a different kind of meaning when I keep hearing it. Paradox. There they were praying for my soul, but not my soul gripped in its real sins. Not to redeem me from my odyssey and sloth and waste. Not to rectify my gluttony. Not to reduce pride and male ego driven to excess. Not to free me from the grip of revered illusions. Not to temper the lecherous male impulse. No, no.
But to have the gods take away the few real virtues I had come by, virtues defining my finest hour. Paradox? Oh. As with all human souls, we are Prometheus, both free and bound, rendered the embraceable man in that freedom and in that binding. T.S. Eliot, you're right. I was walking around old Westminster Abbey, and there on that marble floor, I saw it. There it was. The flame over the marker of old T.S. And a single stem rose coming up through the flame. Because he said, the fire and the rose are one. And I've lived long enough to know how true that is in the paradox. Ask J. Reuben Clark the way he went out of the First Presidency. Got so President McKay and his good friend Stephen Richards could outvote him and ignored him, and they didn't even invite him to the meetings. Sat wasting away in the wheelchair. The powerful coming to the least. And you take Lyndon Johnson. Did any man ever humiliate an opponent so overwhelmingly so and go out so overwhelmingly broken and crushed? Paradox. Isn't it powerful? Paradox. And I looked into Atlanta, and there he was, old Cassius Clay of Muhammad Ali, with his Parkinson quiver, wandered into the Olympic Village, and the best athletes on God's earth surrounded him for the autograph. And the strongest man on this earth was in the Olympics as the weakest. So T.S. Eliot, oh, we shall not cease then, Carl, from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. I grew up as a red-headed, freckle-faced boy on the farm on the Ute Indian Reservation, and I had to milk 13 head of cows during the war, night and morning, and I had to take that team on the plow out until it was too dark to plow. And I thought this, to quote Dickens, was the worst of times. And 50 years later, I left the streets of Chicago and drove to the old homestead on the Uinta Basin and walked the ditch banks where I used to shoot pheasants and drive the horses and herd the cows and bind the grain and swear at the broken down team forehead on the binder. Oh! And I thought, T.S., you're right. And my daddy never owned a key to our house. The best of neighbors, clean air, quiet nights. The crickets would croak at night as we sleep in the hammock under the cottonwood trees. And it was a serenity I could have never known experiencing it. And was it a good thing for a young, lecherous teenage boy to be driven daily with consistent, hard, manual labor? Oh, or would I have done better growing up in the city streets to know the place for the first time? Close off now. Let's close it. Summary, if paradox is to become the most effective teacher, then we must each be a worthy student of what it can teach. And my only purpose here today is to maybe help a singular person be a little more conscious than otherwise of its potential. It is best that each of us formulate our own list of what constitutes paradox and enter these into our journals, because that gets the thinking process going and sustains it, you see, and helps us to reflect upon the experience which is ours so that we can mine meaning out of it. Otherwise, wisdom itself eludes us. includes closing, may I suggest two or three lessons worthy and quickly that we might start our list with. One, Learned Hand and Cromwell. Cromwell, I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken. A saying which Judge Learned Hand would like to have, he said, quote, written over the portals of every church, every school, every courthouse, and of every legislative body in the United States of America. And it ought to be written over our own hearts. Whenever we are absolutely right about our truth claim, we ought to pause momentarily and entertain the possibility that we may be absolutely wrong. Bloom at Yale has declared Joseph Smith the greatest prophet since Moses. As paradoxical as that may seem to the entire Christian world, is it possible that it could be right? And Daniel Bornstein, what a magnificent historian he is. The greatest obstacle to discovery is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. Can you sense the magnificence in that statement? Quote, says Bornstein, I have observed as a historian that the world has suffered far less from ignorance than from pretensions to knowledge. It is not skeptics and others, but fanatics and ideologues who menace decency and progress. No agnostic ever burned anyone at the stake or tortured a pagan, a heretic, or an unbeliever. Carl Pascal, and I am closing, said, man, you yourself are a grand paradox, you old piece of glorious slime. That's mine, not Pascal. But know then, proud man, what a paradox you are to yourself. What a chimera then is man. What a novelty, what a monster, what a chaos, what a contradiction, what a prodigy. Judge of all things, imbecile worm of the earth, depository of truth, a sink of uncertainty and error, the pride and refuse of the universe. Wretched as we are. Nephi said that at the beginning of the Psalm of Nephi, one of the most glorious sentences ever written in Holy Script, when he could tell the world, O wretched man that I am. Isn't that beautiful to know and be sensitive and attuned to the gulf between the man I am and what I strive for. And never forget that aphorism of Pascal, men never do evil so completely and so cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. Can you embrace a man who could write that and hardly live to be 40? If we are to attune to our topic, you'll note I've quoted Hand, Bornstein, Bloom, Joseph Smith, and Jesus Christ, all Jews, teaching us how to be Christian. Now, isn't that a strange paradox? Wisdom? Was there ever Mary so rare a possession? Wisdom. Was there ever so rare a possession? So Aeschylus, the old Greek salt, gives the closing word. Pain that cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart until in our despair there comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. I say in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.